The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here. I'm not a big fan of trigger warnings, but this podcast contains some explicit material. It also contains, more significantly, some very upsetting material related to sexual violence. If that's going to be a problem for you, you should probably skip this episode.
I had actually sent my agent out to London to go image his workstation. We thought he would be there working. And so we had dispatched our lead case agent to the embassy to go do some investigation there. And he was gonna go in at night when Mr. Ford wasn't at his workstation. And he kept calling me saying, the guy's not here, he's not here. And we were like, where the heck is he? And they determined, like, after the second or third day, that Mr. Ford was actually back here in Atlanta visiting his family. So we very quickly threw together an arrest, a complaint, an indictment. I mean, we had basically a 1 week window of opportunity to arrest him in the United States. And we arrested him as his family and he were leaving the airport in Atlanta.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 24th, 2016. A few weeks ago, the Brookings Institution released two major studies of so-called sextortion, online extortion in which perpetrators demand that victims produce pornography for them. This week, I sat down with Mona Sedke, a federal computer crimes prosecutor who handles sextortion cases. We talked about the different cases she's prosecuted. We talked about how sextortion interacts with federal law. We talked about the difficulty of getting victims of this new form of sex crime to come forward. And we talked about how sextortion relates to physical world sexual violence. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 176, Mona Sedke on prosecuting sextortion. So I want to start with just having you introduce yourself and give a sense of what your engagement with this subject has been.
Okay, well, my name is Mona Sedke, and I'm a senior trial attorney at the Department of Justice, where I've been almost 10 years. And I'm in this section called the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property Section, part of Main Justice here in Washington, D.C., and I'd say about 5 years ago, an agent that I work with very regularly, actually in large data breach cases, in point-of-sale hacking cases, he works in New Hampshire, and he's a fantastic agent. He's probably one of the best in the country. And he called me on a Friday, and he said, we've got a sextortion investigation going, and it's live right now.
Had you ever heard that word before?
Never. I had no idea what he was talking about. He told me the fact pattern. I don't even know if he used the word sextortion. He told me what had happened, and it was he had gotten a call from a local police department, which happens a fair amount in smaller towns when the local police will get a complaint and there might be electronic evidence and they need to use ECPA process or the provider is out of state and it's just easier and more expeditious for the federal government to get involved and use our tools to find someone and find someone quickly. And the victim was the mother. She was a single mother of a two-year-old son. And she was terrified. She was moving out of her apartment because she was getting harassing email messages from somebody she didn't know using a fake name. And he had sent her copies of naked photos of her that she had never shown or shared with anyone. She had taken them with her and her husband and kept them on her laptop and had never uploaded them and had never emailed them. And she had no idea who this person was or how he got them. He knew a lot about her. He knew the name of her son. He knew the name of her ex-husband. He knew where she worked. And he was sending her these taunting email messages demanding that she perform very specific sex acts for him in very specific places. It was a level of control and power. Reading the email messages that Friday made me want to vomit and find him quickly. And so we worked all weekend, and we had some great help from providers all over the country who also take these types of cases very seriously. And we were able, in fairly short order, I would say it was probably 4 or 5 days, to identify who was sending her the messages. And it turned out it was one of her best friend's husband. And oddly, well, maybe not oddly, once she actually found out who it was, I think some of the fear and terror subsided a little bit for her. The first 5 days where she had no idea who this person was, or she kept thinking he was around the corner and was going to attack her or hurt her child. And she was as much worried about the embarrassment of having the photos distributed, because he kept saying, oh, if you don't, you know, basically masturbate on a video camera in the bathroom right now, and he would give her these time deadlines, like, I'll give you 2 hours, and if you don't do it at this deadline, I'm going to send these photos to, and he would start listing the names of her employers. She had no idea where he was going with this and whether he was going to physically assault her or otherwise hurt her or her family. And so, and as I said, she was so afraid for her safety that she had moved out of her apartment. And so we got him arrested very, very quickly, and learned after the fact that he had other victims, not surprisingly, because I think a lot of times these are serial repeat offenders. And so we ended up prosecuting him federally for, I think it was either interstate threats, or perhaps it was the federal cyber stalking statute, which is 18 U.S.C. 2261A. And he confessed, gave a pretty fulsome confession, and he eventually pled guilty. And at the sentencing hearing, she came and spoke and gave a very, very powerful sort of statement about the impact that it had on her. And it was very... I really wanted to protect her. I really wanted to get him off the streets. He was a really dangerous person. And just sort of from a personal level, I felt very just personally energized to try to help victims like this.
And so what kind of a sentence did he get? And was that, in your judgment, satisfying from the point of view of protecting people like her and getting people like him off the streets?
Well, I believe we ended up getting about a 3-year sentence for him. And part of that was because he was prosecuted by the states for... The way he had gotten her photographs was he had actually broken into her apartment and stolen her laptop. And so he was prosecuted by the states for basically burglary or breaking an entry. And so by the time he got sentenced for our case, his criminal history was now higher. So that got him from what probably would have been a 1.5-year sentence up to a 3-year sentence. And the judge was glad to be able to give him 3 years. I felt like 3 years was pretty fair, given the fact that it was really, we only had one victim and the period of harassment really had been about 5 days. And there were about a dozen or so messages. And he never did actually follow through on the threats and distribute. And so those factors, 3 years felt about right to me.
So since then, you have become certainly one of, if not the most prolific federal prosecutor in sextortion cases, right?
I mean, well, there are some others. There's a cadre of us. There are a cadre of us at DOJ that we all know one another. We consult one another a lot. We are very committed to these types of cases and these issues. When we saw your report come out, I forwarded it to all of my colleagues who are in this kind of cadre of people who are very passionate about the issue. I have brought, you know, three cases that are filed, and I have some others that are not yet filed. But there are certainly others in the Central District of California and some other places that have brought a number of cases as well. But I love these cases, and I hope to do them for the rest of my career.
So in the Villegas case is a somewhat unusual case, at least for the data set that we compiled. It involves a sort of intimate abuse of somebody the defendant knows. It involves a one victim kind of highly targeted. Most of these cases that at least that I've seen are much less directed than that, much more indiscriminate. You also prosecuted one of the most colorful of the sextortion cases, and it provides an interesting counterpart to Villegas. So let's talk a little bit about Mr. Ford. And
so Mr. Ford was, he followed the what I call the buckshot approach to sextortion, as opposed to the rifle approach to sextortion. And over the course of about, oh, I think it was 5 to 7 years while he was working at the embassy in London, he started.
That's the U.S. Embassy.
The U.S. Embassy in London. He started a phishing campaign, basically pretending to be one of the email providers' account deletion teams. And he would collect email accounts of primarily, he was looking for young women who were members of sororities in college and also aspiring models. And that seemed to be his target audience. And he would sort of spam them, essentially, with phishing messages, claiming that their accounts were going to be deleted. At 11:59 that night, he had a little fake IP address in there and the logo and saying, "I need your password unless you want your account deleted." And he collected several hundred women's passwords. And then he hacked into several hundred women's accounts using those passwords, looking for compromising photos of them and also personal identifiable information about them or their friends or family members. And he spent a lot of time all day long obsessively reading and culling these women's accounts. And he would start with their email account, then he would try to get in their Picasa account, then their iCloud account. And fortunately for us, he kept copious notes of his activities. And he had an elaborate spreadsheet with all of the passwords on the left-hand column and the different accounts across the top with yes, no to see which passwords had worked for the various accounts. And once he was able to get his prized possession, which is a photograph, he would then use a different fake name and a different account and start sending them sextortionate email messages saying, "Look what I have." And he would, of course, attach the stolen photograph. And then his demand was a little unusual. So he wasn't in the main looking for more photographs of the women. He wanted the women to go into locker rooms and changing and clothing store changing rooms and swimming pool locker rooms and bathrooms and public non-public areas, but group areas where people would be changing their clothes. And he wanted them to take voyeuristic videos of what he would call sexy girls changing their clothes, taking their clothes off. And he would say, you know, "If you don't do this by such and such a date, I'm going to send this photo, and he would list the names and addresses of their parents, their employers, their classmates, their professors, whatever. And he followed through on his threats a number of times, and he would very cruelly distribute the photographs of the women. He did have one male victim, too, and he distributed that photograph to that young man's mother with sort of cruel messages attached to them. And so we found out about him because, thank God, one of the victims went to the police. She went to the FBI. And the FBI quickly realized that the IP address that was, you know, they did a header analysis of the email, and they could tell that the IP address was traceable to a State Department computer, a block of IP addresses that the State Department owned. So they contacted the DSS, which is the Department of State's security group. And DSS figured out in very short order, their technical people figured out the exact workstation that was sending out these sextortionate email messages.
But to be clear, this had been going on for 5 or 6 years.
It does appear that it had been going on for a while.
And this was out of a U.S. embassy.
Correct.
So should I mean, when I first read about the Ford case, my reaction to this was that there was a Google employee who was prosecuted in, you know, and so I read about the sort of Google employee who's prosecuted, this U.S. State Department employee who's prosecuted, and I'm thinking there must be sextortionists on, like, everywhere, you know, it sort of suggested to me that that we're looking at the small tip of a very large iceberg. If you can say, well, U.S. Embassy London, well, we got one there, right? Mm-hmm. And so how singular do you think this incident is? Or should we just assume that in any large workplace, in any large employer, somebody's going to be doing something like this?
I don't know the answer to that. I think that sextortion is definitely becoming a bigger and bigger problem. I don't have a sense of how prevalent it is. I don't think it's unusual. I mean, I think that even just anecdotally, a lot of my friends and family and colleagues know the types of cases that I bring, and many people will anecdotally say that things like that happened in their kids' school or college or whatever. So I think it is becoming a much, much, much bigger problem. And it is, but I don't really have a sense for the scale of how many people are doing it at work, for example, as opposed to at home.
But for him to be able to do it for 5 years before you catch him strikes me as evidence for a high degree of impunity, in contrast to Villegas, who manages it for 5 days, right? But it does seem like when you're doing these buckshot, to use your term, highly indiscriminate attacks, you're kind of lost in the cybersecurity ether, and there's just a lot of space to maneuver.
Well, I don't blame... I certainly don't blame the State Department. We didn't have any complaints. So as soon as we got the complaint, the time between when the FBI got that very, very first complaint to the time that Mr. Ford was in custody was very short. And so when you don't have complaints about anybody on your network, you know, it's a lot trickier to figure out what kind of monitoring are you going to be doing with no complaints at all. So I do not blame sextortion victims at all, and I think they are very real, important victims. I don't blame networks that have bad actors on them committing sextortion. And so I found the people at the Department of State were very helpful, very fast, very good investigators. I think we arrested him very quickly. given the time between when the first complaint came into the FBI and when he was in custody.
And if memory serves, he was prosecuted in Georgia, is that right?
He was. So what
happened? Based in London, caught at Dulles Airport, prosecuted in Georgia.
That's right.
So sort of an unusual sex crime in that regard.
Yeah, so what had happened was I had actually sent my agent out to London to go image his workstation. We thought he would be there working. And so we had dispatched our lead case agent to the embassy to go do some investigation there. And he was going to go in at night when Mr. Ford wasn't at his workstation. And he kept calling me saying, the guy's not here. He's not here. And we were like, where the heck is he? And they determined, like, after the second or third day that Mr. Ford was actually back here in Atlanta visiting his family. So we very quickly threw together an arrest, a complaint, an indictment. I mean, we had basically a one-week window of opportunity to arrest him in the United States. And so we fast-tracked our investigation. It was very all hands, and we arrested him as his family and he were leaving the airport in Atlanta. And we took a lot of care. He was there with his wife and child, and we made a lot of efforts to make sure that they did not see him get arrested. We didn't want the child to be upset at all or see any of it. And so it was and then he gave a 3-hour confession at the airport. And so it was a lot of very good detective work and some luck. Our plan actually had been to probably wait and try to extradite him, which would have taken years, but we got really lucky.
So you've had a third case as well that's still different from either of these two.
Mm-hmm.
But give us an overview of that.
Well, I can't talk about that one as much because that one's heading to trial soon. But it is a little bit of an amalgam of the two. It's a person who knows the bulk of his victims, and there were more like 20. But I'd rather kind of stay away from that one because it's still in litigation.
Fair enough. One way that people talk about these cases, and actually the Justice Department is a good example of this. If you look on the Justice Department's webpage for discussions of sextortion, it is pretty uniformly focused on child exploitation. The FBI, even more so, arguably. When the major Justice Department statement related to sextortion in April, which immediately preceded our report, is entirely in the context of a strategy against child exploitation. Your cases all involve adult victims. And in my research, we've found that a substantial minority, but a surprisingly large number of cases involve adult victims as well as or exclusively with respect to child victims. So I guess my first question is, how should we think about sextortion? Is it a generic sex crime? Is it a creature of child exploitation? Like, what is it relative to age of the victim?
You know, I can't really speak to the minor part of this because virtually all of my victims have been adult women. And my guys are all very interested in women who are basically in their early 20s, maybe late teens, sometimes as early as like young 30s. And I think of the crime as, at least vis-a-vis that audience, as really an assault, as a sex crime. These aren't people who are getting sexual gratification, in my view, from tormenting these women. It's the assault, fear, violence by proxy angle that I think is both driving the criminals and harming the women and making me and the Department of Justice more broadly very interested in staying involved in this area because it is a really, really damaging crime for very vulnerable populations.
So one of the things I've never done, which you have done a fair bit of, is talking to perps in this area. You know, we did this big study of it, but it didn't involve, you know, going to a lot of federal prisons and sitting down with people and sort of asking them what they were thinking. What's driving people to do this? It's a very strange crime. A lot of them seem really different from one another, but when you sit down and you read the texts of the messages they're sending, it's like they're all writing off the same script. And so you have all these weird psychological creatures and motivations that are all sort of boiling down to the same script. And I'm wondering, like, what do you make of the demographics of the people who are doing this? What can we say about who these people are, other than that they're all male? Why are they getting ideas from each other? How are they coming to all be doing this very peculiar activity?
I don't know if they're getting ideas from one another, but I agree with your assessment that there are some real common themes in the actual, like, for example, they often demand the same things. They really want full frontal nudity and masturbation, basically, on camera. They seem very focused on that type of conduct. They like to give time deadlines.
Right.
There's a huge control piece here where they want to impart fear and they want to sense the fear. They thrive on hearing back from the victim and frightening the victim. They love it. And I don't know whether it's innate and there's just something that's making these people behave in similar ways, or they are sharing information, or they're getting ideas from popular culture. I really, truly don't know. And I agree that the demographic is pretty different. I mean, a lot of them are just sort of married, normal, seemingly outward people who have something deep down inside of them that people around them would be very surprised to learn about.
So we both have the sense that this is, you know, the tip of a larger iceberg, that the activity is common, the number of cases brought is not small but is not huge. What are the impediments to bringing these cases? When you say you want to do these cases for the rest of your career, what's the rate limiting step?
Well, I think for me, I need to get the victims to feel comfortable enough to come forward, and that takes some real courage, quite frankly. And in each case, I've had a victim who's been willing to share a very, very private thing that they don't really want to share, and they've been willing to go to law enforcement. And that is something that I would like to figure out a way to make happen more and more. And by letting victims know that you are in a very real victim who is very important to us, and you have not done anything wrong. And so getting that message out to encourage victims to come forward, and also, you know, some victims their first place might be a school or a local police department. You know, I guess I would also hope that to the extent that there are local police departments all over the country, many of whom have a lot of expertise dealing with sex crimes, for example, and they're very good and skilled at dealing with victims of sexual assault and things like that. And there are a lot of analogies. These are very delicate victims, and dealing with this group of victims is tricky. And because they're very traumatized and they're afraid and they feel ashamed, and they really need some special care. And I guess, you know, I would like to encourage victims to come forward, and I would like to encourage local law enforcement to partner with us, with the feds, and join forces with us, and we can help them either jointly work their cases or provide technical assistance to them. I typically have had very meaningful involvement with local police in these types of cases throughout, and it's been very helpful to me.
So one of the things I've been surprised by when I looked at these, when we compiled our data set, is how few of these cases are prosecuted locally and how many of them are prosecuted federally relative to by local prosecutors, which is not what you would expect for sex crimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one possible conclusion from that is that, well, the federal statutes are stronger, so it stands to reason that you know, given a choice of venue, you end up in the place with the stronger possible penalties. But the other element is that these cases are often interstate in nature, and Ford is a good example of that, and that the state laws are not really designed to deal with sort of interstate offenses of that sort. And I'm wondering, as you sit and think about how the system should work, if you're a sextortion victim, who should you call? Is it a local PD thing? You call your local PD and say, hey, someone's doing this to me, and they know to call, you know, the FBI or Mona Sedke or, you know, or is it something that the locals should really not have that much to do with, and this should just be a direct victim to bureau kind of reporting? Like, how should the system work?
Well, I think that's a good question. I actually think that there's a sliver of these cases that could perhaps be perfectly adequately investigated and prosecuted locally. If the defendant and the victim know one another, if they're ex-romantic and partners or whatever, and it's a very localized feel, you know, I certainly don't want to presume that I would be better at prosecuting that case than the locals would be. But I think that a lot of times a local authority may not realize that there are many other victims involved, for example. They have one person who comes in and complains, and they don't realize that this is a part of a much bigger thing. So I think outside of the, you know, two people who maybe know one another, and, you know, I don't want to presuppose that we should have some preemption or anything like that. And they could be very well equipped to handle a case like that. But I would encourage a victim to do both. I would encourage a victim to talk to their local law enforcement and talk to their federal law enforcement. And believe it or not, I mean, I have worked with the FBI. The Secret Service is actually, they were the ones on the Villegas case, and they're on my New Hampshire case. And the reason that the Secret Service gets involved is they have great relations with local police because they do all this protection work. And they have great technical skills. So when a local police has, like, IP addresses that they can't figure out, they know their local Secret Service agent who has some technical capabilities, and they could certainly reach out to any number of federal law enforcement entities, but certainly the FBI is one and a great partner, but there are others as well. And I would say both. I don't think you need to choose one or the other. And I would say, you know, I'd like to have local prosecutors and local investigators know that we are very interested in these cases and take them very seriously and are pretty good at investigating them. If I do say so myself, we have some good tools and some you know, nationwide process, and we've been, especially in my section, you know, we're pretty adept at tracking computer criminals.
So that's actually a good segue. You're in the computer crime section, which at some level, when people say the word sextortion and understand what it is, makes a certain amount of sense that it would be prosecuted by computer crimes prosecutors. At another level, somebody says, well, wait a minute, it's kind of a sex crime. Yeah, as you said earlier, mm-hmm. What's it doing in the computer crime section? And then you also said that you'd brought one of these cases as an interstate cyber stalking, mm-hmm. which is kind of in its own. So I want to talk about, like, what statutes we're using here.
Okay.
As you know, in our report, we suggested a discrete federal statute. Mm-hmm. Leave that aside, and let's just talk about the tools that we have. If somebody is sextorting somebody else, what is the universe of federal laws that you have access to to bring a case against him?
Well, we have a number, and I'd say my starting point is always 2261A. That is the federal cyber stalking statute. And the elements in a nutshell are, you know, course of conduct with intent to cause serious emotional distress. And involves, it's like the internet or something like that. It has to have some sort of interstate nexus. And that is a very, I think, powerful tool that I use in many of my cases because it, A, covers a wide range of conduct, and B, it was amended in 2013, so now the defendant and the victim can live in the same state, and it's just become easier and easier to use as a prosecutor, and it also has some pretty good sentencing guidelines that are attached to it. Then there is also 1030, which is basically the computer hacking statute that I use in all of my other cyber cases. There's a component that up until about 3 years ago I had never used before. And lucky for me, 1030A7 basically penalizes hacking for purposes of extortion. That's sort of in a nutshell. And many of the sextortion cases involve hacking. They're hacking basically to steal the photos, to steal the personally identifiable information, or to just take control, deface, monkey with, and harass the sextortion victim. If they can't find photos, they're still hacking to take control and to perpetrate the crime. So if I have both, and I will often charge them in tandem, I'll often charge 2261A and 1030A7. The other sort of statute that we use a fair amount with a sextortion case is 875D, 18 U.S.C. 875D, which is basically the interstate threats to harm a reputation. 875D, it has a 2-year statutory maximum, and the guidelines, the base offense level for the guidelines is quite low, and so it is usually not very attractive, but I still charge it. And that's it. And then I will say, if there are any potential child pornography charges, I will always involve, there's a whole section at DOJ, and each U.S. Attorney's Office all over the country has special prosecutors that deal in child pornography offenses. And if any of my cases have a hint of minor victims, I always bring in to my case team someone who specializes in that area to help me evaluate potential charges.
At the end of the day, you're a computer crimes prosecutor who describes this as a sex crime. How should we think about that? I mean, this is what animated me to get involved in this issue was that it seemed like the first time in human history you could sexually assault somebody remotely. And that it seemed to bring together things that we think of as highly intimate in terms of violence, i.e. that require physical presence, with the issues that we think about mostly in terms of cybersecurity. So your position, which is functioning as a sex crimes prosecutor in the context of a computer security section, mm-hmm. seems to like represent all that kind of tied in a neat package. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
So when I was trying 5 years ago, when I did the first sentencing memo for my first sextortion case, I was a challenge that I had, which you have clearly accomplished, is how to describe this crime for a judge or a jury. Like, what is this crime? Because my job is to give a voice to the victim who sometimes may not be there. And I liken this crime as it really, in my mind, it is no different from having a man, the defendant, standing in front of the woman victim with a baseball bat and forcing her to take her clothes off for him while he videotapes her. And it's that very real sense of violence that I think you described so well. And I do think that's what this crime is about. It's also about privacy. And so, oddly enough, I wear sort of two hats at CSIPs. I do a lot of the big data breach investigations involving point-of-sale hacks and things like that, which is really protecting people's money, people's credit cards, people's PII. I have a bunch of, you know, big, long sentences that I've gotten in cases where people overseas have reached into U.S. consumers' computers and stolen their DOB, SSN, or payment card numbers. And that bucket of my work is not that totally dissimilar from protecting the privacy of these women, because some of them have taken photos of themselves. Not all, but some of them have. And I am not here to punish or judge or I am here to protect people who want to do things in their private life and keep their photographs and their information about themselves private. And so in that way, being in my section, it is sort of a blending of how DOJ is protecting consumers' privacy, whether it's their financial privacy or their intimate life privacy.
Sextortion as a extreme form of data breach.
Exactly.
One of the things I really struggled with when we were writing this report is what justice looks like. So if you take somebody like Michael Ford, who, how many victims did he have? 50?
He had 70, I think he had 75 actual, like, sextortion victims. He had more hacking victims.
Right.
I believe it was 75.
So if you say, if you take the example that you just gave, where Michael Ford had broken into the bedrooms of 75 women and held a baseball bat and made them, you know, do the things he made people do while he filmed it for his own sense of control and gratification. And then you said he'd gotten 5 years or...
almost 57 months.
57 months. We would say that's a nauseatingly low sentence for this. On the other hand, if you say, you know, charge each of those as a separate sex offense, he would, you know, probably be in prison for the rest of his life. And if we did that in a sextortion case, people would say, but wait a minute, there really is a difference between having somebody break into your room and threaten you with a baseball bat and having somebody break into your Facebook account or your Gmail account and threaten you with exposure of intimate material. And so I go back and forth with myself about what the right answer to this question is. And in our report, we kind of fudged it, honestly, because what we set a pretty high maximum sentence, but didn't specify any minimum. So the idea is you could kind of work down from there. But I'm interested in your thoughts about the limits of the analogy to real-world sexual assault. How much can you and to what extent can't you analogize a serial sextortionist to a serial rapist or a serial sexual abuser of some sort?
You know, I like you, I struggle with this exact same issue. I've debated this, the baseball bat analogy, with colleagues and friends, and it works for me. It doesn't work for some people. They don't feel like that's the crime. And the other thing that I really struggle with is I don't want to minimize. I've never been a rape victim. I've never been a victim of a sexual assault. No member. I don't know anyone who has. And I've never prosecuted that type of case. And so I don't want to in any way detract from someone who has been a victim of a hands-on sexual assault by saying that these two things are exactly identical and should be treated the same way. And, you know, this is sort of an aside, but I read the Stanford rape victim's letter, and I was reminded by so many of the same feelings that my victims have in my sextortion cases. And yet, it's not the same crime. It is not the same crime. And I don't want to, in any way, I certainly want to bring up the sextortion victims, and I want them to be, you know, I want to give them a voice and give them their pain real meaning, because it is real injury. But by the same token, I don't want to do anything that would in any way detract from someone else who's had a physical violence crime committed against them. And so I struggle with what is the right analogy. And in terms of the follow-through of what is the right sentence, You know, a lot of things go into a sentencing recommendation. Some of it is, for example, not just how many victims he had, but how angry and ugly was the back and forth with each victim. Like, you just sort of get a sense. Some of them are like, they try it, it doesn't work, they move on. They try it, it doesn't work, they move on. Others are really ugly and committed and obsessed with the same victim. And they're more dangerous, in my view, when they're like that. In the cases that I have worked on, and they now number in the hundreds of victims cumulatively, without exception, there were a significant number of victims who seriously worried for their physical safety. Now, we happened to know that the defendant wasn't actually going to rape them or stab them or do whatever, but they certainly did not know that.
Yeah, and sometimes they don't know that he's not right around the corner.
Exactly.
You know, we know in retrospect, or you knew, learned in real time, that actually he's in London. But the victims, they don't have a sense that he's not two blocks from them.
Absolutely not. And because he knows so much about them, he's ticking off all of these intimate details about where they live and who their friends are. And it makes it much, much, much more personal, scary, terrifying, and controlled. You know, these girls are women and you know, girls too. They are... they're really afraid, not just for the humiliation, but for their safety. And by the way, I don't want to downplay the humiliation factor. I mean, I have a family member who had a semi-nude photograph of herself distributed widely, and it was, you know, if that had happened to a different person who was in a different stage of her life, this was at a teenager, very vulnerable time of her life, you know, she had people in a number of different schools, dozens and dozens of people she never knew, and she learned that her photo against her will, and I know revenge porn is different from sextortion, but I do want to give voice to this, the devastating nature of having a topless photo that you took, maybe not even knowing that someone took it of you, in her case, distributed widely to people in your community. I mean, it could drive a young woman who's already in a very precarious time of her life just by virtue of her age into a serious depression, into needing to change schools, into much, much worse. And I think that, you know, these would-be sextortionists also need to realize that, you know, this isn't just mild annoyance. This is my victim in the Villegas case. She ultimately committed suicide, and I don't think that it was directly related to the sextortion. It happened after he was sentenced, but she was really, really, really devastated by this crime, and having your private photograph sent around can be devastating. So I don't want to minimize just the exposure of the photograph angle. What these sextortion crimes really is about is forced pornography, which is what you point out so eloquently in your report. I mean, can you imagine forcing a young woman to victimize herself? I mean, it's bad enough to, like, take a picture of her and steal it. And, you know, but to then try to force her against her will to take naked photo and videos of herself for your enjoyment, let alone to spread to other people. It's a very, very disturbing crime.
You have a very strong level of individual commitment. Your section has a bunch of these cases. Is that a reflective of the general posture of the Justice Department? I mean, do you feel supported in your work in this by the department?
100%. 100%. I have the full support of my management to basically take any sextortion case that I feel like I want to do. They like having me in this space. They're incredibly supportive. They're letting me come here and talk to you today about it. We are actually age blind at DOJ, not in the cute way. I don't feel like the child victim cases get put on any more of a pedestal than the adult victim cases. I don't work on the child victim cases because that's a different section and I have no expertise with those statutes. But I have never gotten the sense that the department somehow takes those more seriously in any way. And I would say the same thing about all of my fellow prosecutors that work in this space. We don't see a distinction.
So one last question, and then I'll let you go. One of the things that really struck me about the pattern of federal cases when we put together our data is how unevenly distributed it is, that there are certain districts that seem to produce a disproportionate number of these cases, and certain districts don't produce any. Two of your cases have been in New Hampshire, which is, I wouldn't have thought of as a sort of particular sextortion hotbed had I been predicting these things. I hypothesized in the report that the reason was that certain districts have individuals who've kind of caught the bug about these things and been really attuned to them and really concerned about it. Is it that individualistic, or is this just where the cases are coming from?
My section puts on a one-week training session for computer hacking and IP prosecutors all over the country. We do it every year, and I'd say at least every other year, we have a several-hour session devoted to sextortion. And there are 150 prosecutors in the room. And I would venture to say that any of those prosecutors sitting in that room are sitting there because they'd like to learn more about the statutes and bring the cases. I don't think people are turning away the cases in the U.S. Attorney's Office. I've never heard that. I'd be surprised if that were true. I can't tell you the number of times. Today, right before I came, I consult on a lot of sextortion cases all over the country, and people will call me and they want me to review their pleadings or talk about their charges. And I just had a woman today, and I probably had one last week, say, hey, if you ever get one of these cases, bring it my way. And I told her the same thing. I was like, hey, if you get one, bring it my way, because I'd like to be in this space more and more and more. And I think we are very, very eager to prosecute these cases.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. We have made serious progress in getting more ratings and reviews on iTunes. We're up to 36 now, and I'm pleased to say they're pretty much all good. If you haven't done so already, please take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. We don't advertise the Lawfare Podcast, so word of mouth is all we've got. That's word of your mouth. Please, our music, as ever, is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.